This episode is brought to you by HivePass. HivePass is the latest in membership management software that brings a radically different approach to how members join your organization, their experience as a member, and how you interact with them. Built by not only an app developer, but also a mountain biker, HivePass was made by a trail user for trail users. With an app-based platform, instant digital membership cards, ability to send push notifications to members, in-app trail status reports unique to your organization, HivePass is building the next generation of membership management software for your organization. Future additions to HivePass include an event system, automated custom trailhead signs, and much more. HivePass has been live in New Zealand and Australia for a few years, but just launched in Canada, and with this announcement, the United States. Over 50,000 trail users already use HivePass to support their local trail organization. HivePass is the world's first app-based membership management software built specifically for trail organizations. For all of the details, check out hivepass.app. That's www.hivepass.app. Or download the HivePass app today. You're listening to Frontlines, a podcast for the people that truly make mountain biking happen. Not the riders, racers, or product designers, but the builders, advocates, and the often forgotten board members of your local mountain bike trail association. This week, the podcast celebrated 8 years, a milestone I'm very proud of. We're also getting very close to another milestone, one that's been on my horizon for quite a while, and that will be our 100th episode. We're slowly chugging our way to a point that most podcasts never make it to. In fact, most podcasts don't make it past 8 episodes. And honestly, I owe so much thanks and gratitude for all of you who have listened, and an even bigger thank you to all of those who've supported the podcast financially. Stay tuned at the end of this episode where I'll have a bonus interview with Flan McKenzie of HivePass. But before that, I'm your host, Brent Hillier, and this is episode 95 of Frontlines. I'm joined by two guests today. The first is Patrick Lucas. He's the executive director for the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Awesome. Great to be here, Brent. Thank you for having me.
And my second guest is Thomas Schoen. He's the director of the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program and CEO of First Journey Trails, a trail building company in British Columbia. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, Brian. Good to be back. Thanks.
Yeah, it's good to have you back as well. So gentlemen, it's I've always enjoyed all the episodes that we've recorded together, and a big fan of kind of what the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program has done in the past and is doing. And I think for many of my guests, they probably are familiar with some of the programs and some of the episodes in the past, but I'm sure there's also a lot of guests who perhaps haven't heard those or maybe need a refresher. So maybe to start off with, let's just discuss a little bit about what the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program is and kind of the projects that you work on.
The Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program is it's a nonprofit registered here in British Columbia in Canada. And primarily what we do is we work with First Nations all over BC, and now in Ontario as well, to help those nations plan, design, build, and maintain high quality and sustainable single track nature trails that folks can use for a multitude of uses, including walking, hiking, and biking, and various cultural practices. And so we've done that. And I was going through our numbers the other day. It's actually more than 50 First Nations all over BC. We've built more than 200 kilometers of trails, and we've trained more than 500 youth and community members to become professional trail builders.
That's awesome. You know, I think it really highlights what is so amazing about mountain biking, in the sense that we are, you know, the subject matter expert right now when it comes to trails. And I think it really highlights the importance, or one of the things that I really enjoy about being a trail builder is that we might look at this, or we might enter the world of trail building as mountain bikers, but we do so much more than build mountain bike trails. And even from a small perspective, we do so much more for building trails for all users, but also that trails mean so much more than just something that we walk on or something that we bike on. And I think, you know, what I've seen from the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program is that that is really highlighted on the value of these trails that have been created for these communities. Can you kind of speak a little bit about, you know, maybe an example or maybe what happens when you kind of build trails within a community and you get the community involved in that process?
Yeah, I'll jump in here, Brian. It's really nice that you recognize that this is just so much more than trail building. Like Pat and I, we often say we're literally and figuratively are connecting communities. We're connecting parts of indigenous communities where the resources are often divided into clusters of homes. So we're building trails that connect the communities within, but we're also connecting the indigenous community with the settler communities in Canada, where we're making connections between mountain bike clubs and indigenous communities, where we're bringing non-indigenous volunteers with us onto indigenous lands, indigenous communities to help us build these trails. So it absolutely goes beyond the trail as a recreational means. It becomes almost an example of how we can work side by side in creating something, and that's really what we are all about. It's great to leave a beautiful, well constructed mountain bike trail in a community after we're done for a season, after our programming ends at a certain location, but what's more important to us and to the indigenous communities is the partnerships that have been created throughout that process.
And so what does it kind of look like with the community? Does the community kind of reach out to you? Do you reach out to a community? How do things get started?
For the most part, it's mostly communities reaching out to us. Like, we have done very little, you know, marketing or outreach, just because we don't have to. Every year we have multiple communities who reach out to us and they hear about what we've done in other communities and they decide that they want something like that, for themselves. So every community we work with, we're invited, into that space, and we really place a high priority on listening and, you know, working with the community to help them assess and identify their priorities and needs, and then really following that path as best as we can. There are certain things that we definitely try to encourage, though. So, for example, a lot of communities will often come to me and they say, oh, we want to build a trail between two of our communities and a long linear trail. And it'll be usually a very big project, it'll be like 100-kilometer trail. And we'll always say, that's a wonderful vision. That's, you know, that's really powerful. Let's start small. Let's really look for something in the community where we can build something that will help get people super excited and build momentum. Because one of the things we found is that there's no successful larger trail project without building up a culture around trail use and getting people out on the trails and allowing them to discover kind of how they want to, you know, build that relationship with the land. So that's kind of where we put our focus. So once they invite us in, we'll go through that process, the trail planning, then we help them lay out the trails, design it, and then we return and we train youth and community members to build the trails. And then typically at that point, we take a step back and they continue on with that process. They build trails, and then we'll often maintain a relationship with the community over a period of years, anywhere from 3 to now as many as 10 years. We've been working with some communities. So we'll keep training and we'll kind of keep supporting them in that process.
Yeah. And I think Pat mentioned something that's really important. When he said we return to the communities, and again, that goes hand in hand with what I said earlier. We really do want to create long-term partnership. We want this connection with communities where they feel comfortable picking up the phone or sending us an email and saying, hey, we've got a couple of kids out on the land. Can you give us some advice or can you help us with this? Can you come back next year? We need you again. We want to train a new crew. And in order to facilitate this process, another critical element for us is that we have this one community champion in a community. We need that teacher, that social worker, that healthcare worker who has an interest in trails, who has an interest in hiking, trail running, mountain biking, whatever it is that connects them with our group. But we need that one person to really keep pushing from within the community and to build up the stoke within the community. If that's not the case, then it's very difficult for us to keep those partnerships going.
And so this is something where I think when I hear from you guys, it's when we look at a lot of trails that get built, you know, I think we see these capital investment projects where whether it's a land manager that's a park or a municipality or what have you, there's a recognition that a trail needs to be built or a trail needs to be fixed and realigned or rebuilt. And there's an investment of money. There's a company that is hired. And the multitude of unbelievable trail building companies that exist out there, including First Journey Trails, that land managers have an option to hire and build a good trail. There's so many options out there. But what isn't always there with a lot of trail networks is kind of this maintenance cycle, this community development. And right now, for me personally, a big part of my advocacy work is in hiking trails. And I've actually kind of really, I still work as a trail builder here on the North Shore building and maintaining mountain bike trails. But my advocacy focus is on BC parks and hiking trails. And there's a lack of community that I find in this kind of world. There's a lack of people going out on a regular basis and maintaining these trails. And what I love about this program is empowering people to kind of be active in this process, because trails are not permanent. You can build the world's greatest trail. It's going to require maintenance, just in the same way that you can build, you know, an 8-lane highway. You're still going to need to come back and patch up potholes. So I love that this is such a big part. And then getting the youth involved just kind of ensures a lasting longevity to this as well, that these kids are going to be in this community for a long time, and they're going to potentially be the mentors in the future that are going to continue this process of passing this knowledge down, which is so wonderful.
Yeah. I think at the heart of our program and the most important thing that we've learned from working with the communities is it's all about relations, right? Like, so we're not just trying to build a trail and then trying to, you know, teach folks how to maintain it. It's really about what they're so excited about. And what they really gets a lot of movement in the communities we work with is that they're eager to enhance and kind of rebuild their people's relationship with their lands and territories. And that's what they see the trails at. It's a way to move people and get people and youth particularly out on the land. So that's really what we're focused on, right? Is for a lot of the communities we'll work with, like for the kids, a lot of time it'll be their first time kind of getting out into the forest. And so what you're trying to do is build a trail that facilitates that and allows them to have that relationship with that place. And when we take that approach, that's where we see the greatest success. And there's a few community projects that we've worked on, and we see other companies, trail building companies, work on where they just go in and they build the trails and then they leave. And there's a few spots where that's going to be okay. Like it'll work. But I think the vast majority, it has to be that community relationship building process. Like that has to be the heart of it. Because you're right, because trails are, we like to call them fussy little kittens that need a lot of care, you know, and over time they're going to change and they're going to move like almost like a river through the forest. Like as you rebuild and you maintain them, it's going to change. And, the community has to be involved in that as a relationship in order for that to, be sustainable.
You know, Brent, it's really interesting when we started working with communities, going into communities often for multiple days or up to 2 weeks, we thought we're going into these communities to strictly work on trails, to build mountain bike trails. And what happened over the last years is we spent just as much time getting to know the community. We walk around in the evening in these often very remote, very small villages. We talk to elders. We make connections with youth. We do presentations in the evening. We show mountain bike movies. We talk to chief and council in the evenings, in community meetings. So it really changed how we looked at the scope of our work. We're really not so much going in as trail builders or trainers, crew workshop leaders. It became much more than that. It's a way of establishing connections. And I think Pat said it really well. It's all about creating this excitement around the trails. The actual quality of the trails is not the most important thing here. It's everything around it. It's the creation part.
Do communities kind of expect that, or are they expecting something a little bit different when they invite you to come onto their land?
I would say that the majority of the communities, maybe they don't expect that, because I think, you know, they have a certain expectation of when they're inviting non-Indigenous folks into the community and what they're going to be dealing with. I think they really appreciate the fact that Thomas and I have spent so much time. I mean, Thomas, my gosh, you've been doing this for 25 years, I think, you know, and I've been doing it now for 15 years. Like, we've spent a lot of time in these communities. So we've learned to understand that the real value is in those relations. You know, as Thomas was saying, like, you know, I think this year alone, we attended a number of community ceremonies, you know, and funerals and memorials. And we understand the value of kind of that larger piece that comes into it. So I think they really appreciate that. And we do that because we've learned from them the importance of doing that and how much value is in that. So, for them, it's an expected and a key part of who they are and what they do. And I think because we've spent so much time in the communities that we've learned that that's where the real value is.
The last couple episodes of the podcast, I was focused on New Zealand, and there was some conversations about the Indigenous communities that that are there, and obviously here in Canada and North America, we have Indigenous communities all across this land, and so there's a lot of communities that might be out there that might not be even thinking of how important trails are. And I think there might be neighboring mountain bike communities that might be able to help and some partnerships or partnerships isn't even the correct kind of phrase, like relationships that could happen as we go forwards. What are some of the lessons? You know, I think like the more recent projects that the two of you have worked on are great success stories. But I think what I'm more interested in is those first few projects that both of you worked on. What were the lessons that you learned in those that have kind of changed or sculpted what you do now with various communities.
I want to start by saying that the biggest lesson that we learned is we need to listen to the community, not go into a community from our perspective as passionate mountain bikers and trail builders and push on the community our vision of what is an amazing mountain bike trail, because that might just not what's needed in that particular case, in that particular instance. We need to really dive in deep and sit down with elders, sit down with youth, sit down with community members, and come to an understanding what can be done and what is needed. Is it just that 300 meter connector trail to get youth from the village to a beautiful site along a river where they can go fishing? You know, like we really need to leave our ideas and our vision behind and cater to the communities. And that can only become apparent if we spend a lot of time in those communities and if we take the time to go through a lengthy consultation process and be honest to ourselves and listen and again not push our ideas on that community. I mean, that's what has happened over the last 150 years with these indigenous villages. So we don't want to keep going in that way.
Yeah.
I think you've just heard a perfect example of why Thomas has been such an important part of this program and a mentor to me, because unfortunately my initial days and the initial projects I worked on were not quite so enlightened or evolved. I came at it from a very, I grew up in Canada, my family's from Canada, and we were kind of inculcated in that more, colonial kind of mindset. And when I first started working with communities, I came at it as I was working for this indigenous services company, so a non-indigenous company that provides services to First Nations, and grew up in sort of that background where we're taught to be, you're the expert, you know what's best, go in there and make sure it all goes according to the government's plan, et cetera, and very much caught in that sort of white savior mentality. And I needed to get that kind of broken apart. And so I remember I'd be going to the communities and be like, we're going to do this. We're going to build these trails and it's going to be awesome and it'll be good for you. And they'd be like, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. And they'd show me the door. So it was slowly kind of like realizing and understanding that that wasn't going to work. And working with Thomas, I think, was one of those key pieces. And I met Thomas very much in that space. So I was invited to talk to the Hatsul First Nation. And I remember I went in and we were at a community meeting, and I remember the room was really busy and it was really packed, and I was so excited. I'm like, wow, there's actually people here to listen to me talk. And the Mount Poly mining disaster had happened just a month or so before. And so for your listeners, it was there was a mine called Mount Poly Mine in the Cariboo, and a tailing dam failed and flooded the Quesnel Lake and rivers and bodies of water with, thousands of tons of toxic waste. And this was right in the Hatsul First Nation's backyard. So the chief got up and spoke about it, and they showed picture after picture of all this environmental disaster. And then they're like, all right, Patrick, your turn. And I got up there. I'm like, mountain biking is awesome. And I started showing picture after picture of like dudes in full on mountain bike gear, shredding down the side of mountains with a giant rooster tail of dirt flying out behind them, and it was just going so bad, and I remember like there was a guy sitting in the back of the room with his baseball cap and mustache and a big smile watching me, and that was Thomas. And I just remember shutting my computer being like, okay, you know what, let's just not talk about that. I just like bikes and I want to help you get some kids out on the land. And that's when it all changed. It was Thomas who kind of like had already been working with First Nations for a long time, and we took me on this journey, and we completely changed how we were doing things. You know, so that was a multi-year process for me to kind of break that down. And that's when I really started to ask myself, like, you know, why am I approaching it this way? Like, what is it? Where does this white savior trope come from? And why are we so inculcated with that? And it's deeply embedded in our culture. And it's there for a reason, because it's part of manifest destiny. It was there to justify and rationalize taking indigenous lands and treating them as wards of the state, you know, and you have to sort of step back and break that down. And that's why this program has been so important to me, because I've learned a lot more about what it means to become an accomplice or an ally to indigenous folks, and what it means to actually break that down and ask yourself, you know, how are you perpetuating the colonial system that's been built up around us?
Yeah, what's, you know, got me kind of thinking is that probably since, you know, the start of this podcast, and when we both started speaking to both of you on this show, you know, my relationships with land managers, I think were very different, and I wasn't as experienced as an advocate and for lack of a better term, kind of within the political realm. And I think over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, I've gotten way better at that, but it's very colonial. Like I chair committees now. I'm involved with my municipality. I'm working with my MLA at a provincial level, and it's almost that I've started to really understand how to play that that game. But that game's not, you know, that political realm is not what we're talking about here. And I think when we talk about indigenous communities, they're savvy to these kind of statements. They've been told, you know, these types of promises a lot, and they're very heads up about some white guy rolling into town and promising them, you know, this and that, and it's hard. It's part of that process of decolonizing ourselves to kind of understand that, like, the way that we do things is not necessarily the best way to do things. And maybe we're in a time right now where we're in a political landscape that's very divided in Canada, but and also in the United States. And maybe we're seeing that this isn't even, there's a better way to develop relationships and to develop community. And I can't help but think that when we work with these very relationship forward communities, there's a lesson that I need to take back to my municipality and my, you know, colonial land managers, so to speak, and how we have relationships with them as well. Because I feel, and the phrasing that I've heard both of you say and that I love is doing things in a good way. And maybe we haven't been doing things in a good way in all aspects of our society, and we need to kind of adjust that. There's a stuffiness with government as well, and I think that there's a lot of people that choose not to get involved and choose not to play an active role in their community. And I think as we move forwards into the future, we need people to pick up the shovel, whether it's a literal shovel or a hypothetical shovel, and do their part. And I think that what's amazing about this program is that the youth are getting involved. And I think that's what's maybe not happening in other communities. Like I feel like having a champion to kind of get kids outside and building trails needs to happen in all communities, not just indigenous communities, because it's something that I think our youth are really disconnected from the land. All of our youth are seemingly more and more disconnected from the land.
Yeah, I just think you really hit on something super important, and that's what Patrick recognized from day one on when he started the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program. And I mean, it's in the name itself. Our connection to the community is through youth. It's youth who are opening up doors for us. They go back to their parents, to their uncles, to their peers, and talk about these white guys who are having fun with them, who are out on the land, who are playing in the dirt with them, who put the literal shovel in the ground with them. And through those conversations around the family table in the evening after our program's long over, that really is what breaks down those barriers and what gets us back to the communities in many instances. In so many cases, Pat and I were the first two white dudes coming in working with a couple kids outside of a school setting, outside of a structured program. There are these two random white guys who are just having fun out in the forest playing around with these kids. And really, that is what opens doors. I can't stretch that point enough. So yeah, it's really interesting that you picked up on that. It's awesome.
There's definitely, we need to get more kids out on the land. That's where they're going to learn everything that they need to know going forward. You can't stress it enough. And I think we've seen how transformative these programs can be for the kids. And you really just can't stress enough how much it needs to happen. I love it. We don't always get to see this, but every once in a while we do get to see like non-Indigenous kids who live in the communities, or live in adjacent communities who come and build trail, or various opportunities that we have to do that. And that's, I get really excited about when non-Indigenous and First Nation kids get to work together in those spaces. And that can be a super powerful experience as well. You know, because we grew up, like, we never got to visit those communities. I was really lucky in that I did get some exposure to Indigenous culture when I was pretty young. My family moved around a lot. And we would, you know, live in different communities and we get some exposure. But you know, how many of us to this day, even like when we have events where people come and ride on some of the trails that we've built, and they'll tell me, I've never set foot on a reserve community before. And we always have those stories about how dangerous it is. And, you know, like, you know, or you get like the, you know, the people who are maybe not so enlightened, but they always use as the excuse, I live next door to a reserve, and, you know, but there's no real connection there. And that sometimes that's some of the most important stuff we do, is that we create opportunities for people to interact in ways that they haven't had a chance to do before. And I particularly so important for kids.
I think about this with my son now. He's in grade two, and North Vancouver is kind of a unique community in the sense that we have two Indigenous communities that are, you know, right next to, you know, for lack of a better term, are kind of colonial land managers or districts or municipalities, and they share a school district. So you've got kids that are coming from either one of these communities, and they're in the schools together. But even with that, there's still a division. Like, it's like you don't generally walk over and spend time in those communities, or they might be known here as like, oh, that's kind of the rougher end of town, that type of thing. But what you do get in here, which I certainly didn't grow up with, and it's been interesting kind of seeing my son grow up with this, is that he's got peers, he's got fellow students that come from the Squamish Nation or the Tsleil-Waututh Nation. And I remember I went on a school field trip with him to the local theater, and at the start of the presentation, they did a land acknowledgement. And this little girl who was sitting next to me, she said, that's my people. And she was so proud of it. And I was like, that's great. I love it. Like, you say that every time that happens, because,
yeah.
And it was just so nice to hear her and hear her be proud of that. And I know that's not an opportunity that I think most settler kids get in their communities, that they're not able to be in the same classroom as those kids, because the physical separation, like the remoteness of the vast majority of these communities by design, mm-hmm. from the federal government in a lot of ways, that opportunity is not there. Community building or you know, the ability to meet and break bread and to celebrate together. It's just not there, I think, in a lot of communities.
Yeah. And I mean, it's pretty remarkable to have that scenario where the schools are integrated to some degree and the Indigenous kids are experiencing that level of acknowledgement and representation where they feel a sense of pride and can say that, like, to have a kid say that to you, like, that's my people. You know, when we were kids growing up and we had some First Nation kids in our school, I highly doubt, I cannot believe that would have been their experience. I'm sure it would have been quite negative in a lot of ways. So to know that that's starting to change, that's amazing. And of course, the big difference now is when we go to First Nation communities, you know, they have their own schools. They're learning their language. And like, we work a lot with the schools. Like, they'll come out and do part, like, they'll come out and build a trail with us and it'll be part of their classroom, it'll be part of their outdoor ed class. So we get to hang out with the kids and they're using their language, you know. And one of the things we always ask the kids is like, hey, maybe you can find out what you call this tool in your language, you know, or we'll try and integrate it as much as we can. And that's a really cool part of the experience. And the schools will use the trails. And in some of the communities, one of the things Thomas brought to this is he would teach the kids how to build benches and we create a little learning circle. You know, so the school now can go out on the trails and use that as part of their curriculum. And that's been a really cool outtake of the project that we work on. So whenever I work now with communities, like, we always raise that. We're always saying, you know, the schools can use this. Schools can come out here and teach about language, teach about culture, teach about the history. And that's something they value so much.
As mountain bikers, we have this subject matter expertise of trail building that I think we offer all sorts of communities, you know, whether it's land managers or in both of your cases with Indigenous communities. I think as we kind of see, and I'm going to bring up the phrase that we were just before we hit record, Patrick and I were laughing about the last episode that we recorded, which was about climate change. And I had mentioned to him that it kind of polarized the audience a little bit. I'm confident that the audience that is currently listening is probably made up of mostly people that understand that climate change is real. But what we're kind of seeing, especially here in British Columbia, is, that we've been improperly managing our forests. And that through the 50s and 60s, we had an extensive firefighting program that was identifying when a forest fire was happening and it was putting it out immediately. And these forests were allowed to grow in a way that was not maintained, in the same sense that perhaps they were maintained pre-contact. And we are now seeing massive forest fires. And, you know, this past summer was probably one of the more enjoyable summers that I've had as far as a lack of smoke and a lack of fires kind of restricting my movement throughout the province as I kind of vacation and go ride in different communities. But we've seen some pretty horrific years, and we've seen absolutely destructive events of like communities that we've lost, you know, absolutely gone because of forest fires. And we did have it this year with Jasper. And so where's our kind of future headed? You know, where's the, is there a knowledge set that we need to look to with Indigenous communities on how we better manage our forests? Like, I think we've proven that perhaps our strategy as settlers isn't working. And is there a conversation? Do you have these conversations with communities about ways that forests can be managed better? Or is this maybe a bit too high level from what you guys are kind of working on?
Oh, no, we have those conversations all the time. We work quite extensively with the knowledge keepers in the communities. And once we're out in the woods working together and we've built that trust, they will start sharing that. And a part of the planning process is always, you know, we're talking about animals, we're talking about plants, how they might be impacted by the trails and people being there. And of course, during the wildfires of 2017, 2018, it was very much front of the conversation for us, because we worked in areas that were deeply impacted by those fires. And we learned how the trails played a role in helping them respond to and adapt to the climate crisis. So the communities that we work with, they have, they've extensively managed and been cared for their lands for thousands of years. And even though those knowledge systems have been deeply disrupted by colonialism, they are working very hard to revitalize those and to start implementing those practices again. You know, so all the communities we work with, they had, extensive firekeeper practices, and they managed, carefully cared and managed every square inch of their territories in a way that allowed those areas to thrive. So the fact that we have these amazing landscapes that we can build the best trails in the world with, unbelievable brown pow and mineral gold that we use to build those trails, that's because they manage those lands so carefully for so many generations. And that absolutely has to be part of the conversation going forward. And we are starting to see that shift in BC. Like they are starting to re-implement the firekeeper practices in certain areas. And the trails that we build are kind of part of those talks now. Like, how can the trails be used to manage fuel load and create fire breaks and create evacuation routes and things like that? So we are starting to see that, but that's so slow. And where we are seeing the more robust conversations occur is where those First Nations have taken back control of their lands. And that's where I think we're going to see the most progress.
Yeah. The only thing I want to add, I think Patrick really summarized it perfectly, but the one thing I want to mention is the trail crews that we work with, that we teach over the course of a summer in any given communities, they learn skills that are really transferable when it comes to firefighting. So if we work with a crew of five builders in a small indigenous community in the BC's interior, if a year down the road there is a forest fire, you've got five people who are physically healthier than before the trail building process started. They know their tools. They know how to operate a chainsaw. They use the same type of digging tools that often wildfire crews use. So there is a transferable skill set, and that to be honest, that makes both of us feel really good when we leave a community. And it's just another example that we're not just leaving trails behind in these communities. There is a skill set that gets built up, whether it will be used or not, that's out of our hands, but we're providing it. We're leaving it in the community.
I wonder if that's something that we can do a better job of in other communities. Like I think about where I live in North Vancouver, huge forest interface. And we've had some close calls in the past, whether it's a cigarette butt that gets flicked off the Sea to Sky Highway and starts a fire kind of close to Horseshoe Bay. There's a fire up on Seymour a couple years ago. And just timing wise, it's always kind of worked out that the water bombers have kind of been nearby and they've been able to hit it quick and fast and take it out. But every year I think about, like, man, if something gets out of hand quickly, we're in a lot of trouble. And I don't know if I know that there's an army of trail builders that we have here, but I would love to kind of see a little bit of a formal kind of understanding of just how much maybe volunteers can make a difference in that. And that when it does come to your community, people will go the steps that they need to go to protect it. But I don't know if necessarily that infrastructure is in place. And I know that, like, I see that with, the work that I'm doing right now with BC Parks is there's a particular trail that got maintained and a lot of money was spent to kind of maintain this trail, and it could have been done so much better with a group of volunteers. And so there's not this conversation happening. And maybe it's a scalable thing. Like, it's hard sometimes when we look at a really big community it might be the wheels of bureaucracy kind of struggle to make that change. You know, I hope that in an emergency that those types of things happen, but I don't think they really did in a place like Jasper. I don't think that there was, you know, that same kind of volunteer effort. And, you know, I would love to see a program where it's like, you know, a firefighter reserves or something like that, where I could, you know, maybe 2 Sundays a year, I show up and I get some training and then I'm there for my community. Cause I think it's amazing. You know, the stories I heard from Williams Lake of like what was being done out there during those fires to kind of protect that community in those massive forest fires. And it was that skill set, that trail building skill set that was being utilized in a lot of those people. It's so amazing to kind of hear that. But I don't know if we have that elsewhere in the province and in maybe the larger communities.
Yeah. I don't think we do in any kind of formal way. Like particularly after 2017, when Williams Lake got hit pretty hard and everybody was evacuated, and it was after the fires that we learned from the communities that we had worked with how they credited the trails and the trail building program as being a part of their response. So as Thomas was mentioning, we learned that the trail crews that we had trained up all got jobs in the fire response. They all became a part of the fire response and they performed really well. So we actually worked with the Red Cross, and we highlighted that as an issue, and they funded us for 2 years to do trail building workshops and use the trail program to help those communities who had fire crews to use the trail building to get them prepared. So that, because they were having a problem with like the fire season, they'd have a trail crew, but they'd all be sitting idly waiting for something to happen. And then all of a sudden, you know, the fires would happen and they'd have to go from 0 to 100%. And the members were burning out. They weren't physically fit. They weren't ready to be out there. So they used the trail program to enhance their resilience and their readiness. And I think like what you've said about North Vancouver, I'm like, that's exactly the kind of lesson they could be learning. Because you have a massive community of people who love those woods, love being out in the woods, and are used to working long hours with tools. Like that's a resource that's just sitting there ready to be used. And I don't think anybody's made that connection yet. And I think that's something people should be talking about for sure.
I just want to back up and kind of dig into something you mentioned earlier, the term fire keeper. Mm-hmm. What is that and what does that kind of mean?
Well, a fire keeper is an individual in an Indigenous community. And I don't know tons about it. So I'm going to be careful about how much I say, because I don't know enough about it. But to my understanding is that in the past and still to this day, it's starting to reemerge, but communities had families that their role was specifically to manage the land through the use of fire. So they would go out and, you know, set fires and do controlled burns quite extensively throughout their territories in order to manage it for fuel load, but also to, you know, encourage certain movements of wildlife and plant growth and, you know, to really help the land flourish in a way that was healthy for not only the people, but the you know, wildlife and fauna that lived there. And they used that extensively for thousands of years, and they were extremely skilled and knowledgeable in it. And that's part of what kept the land from being the way it is now, which, as you said, right now, it has become heightened for fuel load and, you know, basically just being perfect for wildfires is what we've done. So that's what a fire keeper was. They were a specific person within a specific family that had that skill set and were recognized and celebrated within their communities having that. So those folks are starting to, you know, engage in those practices again. And the government on a very tentative level are starting to work with those folks. But that's the limit of my knowledge about that. I think there's people out there who could speak much more knowledgeably about that.
Yeah. It's as I kind of learn more about it, it really kind of rocks my understanding of wild spaces, you know, and I've recognized now that the language that I've used in the past to describe the places that I like to recreate in is wrong in a lot of ways. And it's something that, you know, when I'm teaching, guiding, I always try to recognize that the traditional territory that I'm on, but that's just, you know, those can be kind of an empty statement. And so when I do teach a class, whether it's an avalanche class or survival course or a navigation course, I like to share with my students kind of where I'm at in my journey of reconciliation. And over the last little while, where I've been at is trying to catch words that I use that really describe kind of colonial actions. And one of them is the term wilderness. We have this kind of romanticism about wild places. And really that didn't exist. These lands were never abandoned. They were never left to be wild. They were managed. They were lived on. They were gathered on. They were hunted on. And they were never left to be wild. And yet when we create these highly problematic parks, in the sense of like a lot of parks were used to forcibly remove Indigenous people. Banff is a great example of that Indigenous communities were forcibly removed from Banff to create those park spaces. We then kind of leave them and going, look at this beautiful, pristine wilderness. And that didn't exist pre-contact. These spaces were managed. And it would seem abundantly clear that perhaps managed in a much better way than what we've been managing them in the last 150 years. And so I'm excited to kind of see what comes and what happens. And hopefully we're not just, our governments aren't just paying lip service to this kind of Indigenous engagement, that it's actually, you know, to use the phrase again, it's these relationships are being, and this knowledge is being learned in a good way and used in a good way. Because I think that what we've been doing hasn't worked, but even just the way that we think about these spaces is just wrong. It's just not the case.
I think one of the most important things that I'm learning from the communities that we work with, and I'm always kind of grappling with this, but it, you know, even using the terms like managed and it's what I think it really comes down to when you really get a chance to talk with folks and they really, you know, really start learning about it's all about the relationships. Like they very, very carefully are always asking themselves, what is the state of their relations with, you know, the land, with animals, with people around them. They're always, you know, trying to balance those things, you know, and very carefully maintain that balance. And they see it as an obligation that they have to always be very carefully balancing everything that they're doing. And they're always, and you can see, like, for a lot of the First Nation folks, like, it's, you know, it's something they're constantly thinking about. And they're like, you know, are these relationships in balance? Are we doing this properly? Are we observing proper protocols and ceremony? And really, it's this very complicated and nuanced way of looking at the world. And those beautiful places that we look at as pristine wilderness, those were places of deep, deep and intimate and carefully balanced relationships. And they always were, you know, agonizing over, were they doing it right? And, you know, that was something that they were constantly trying to maintain that balance.
Constant self-reflection, I think, is so critical in this too. You know, for me, the trails that I've been working on, I'm always questioning, like, is this the right, you know, from a very small perspective, in the sense that I'm just trying to build this trail in a certain way, and always questioning, like, is this the right way to do this? And always, you know, just because something worked one way in another spot on that trail, and it might not work again, and is something sustainable, and just always trying to get better and better and better. And what I've learned over the last few years as a trail builder is that I've stopped I don't even like that term anymore, because so much of the work that I do isn't even, well, number one, I'm maintaining, I'm not building. But also so much of the work that I do isn't even on the trail. It's adjacent to the trail. It's managing the water to get it to leave the trail, or replanting certain trees, certain plants. And it's about the forest. It's not about the trail at all.
Yeah.
It's about everything that's around it. And then by extension, the community that's there as well. And so, you know, I think, I don't know what a better title is for us, but I don't think Trail Builder is right.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. You know, I mean, I often tell people we have to stop thinking about building new trails and stuff and really start thinking about the trails that we have, which we have extensive trails all over the province, is more like a garden we need to tend.
Yeah.
And I think we need that kind of generational sort of shift in our perspective.
You talk about self-reflection, and I want to pick up on that, because exactly that was the topic of our documentary Dirt Relations that we released early this year. We really wanted to tell our story of self-reflection. Where did we go wrong in the past? How do we see ourselves as these three friends, these three men? There's another person that's missing here today. It's our good friend Tom Eustache from the Simcoe First Nation in BC's interior. And really the whole idea of producing this documentary or telling our story was all about self-reflection. So it really goes hand in hand with our work, obviously. Yeah.
That's great. It's a good segue, because I do want to kind of hear about that film. How can folks find it and view it and see it? I know it was here in town, I think about a year ago for the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival. But how can other folks find this film to take a look at it?
So the film is entitled Dirt Relations, the story of the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program. And right now we're focused really on setting up community screenings. So we haven't put it out on a streaming platform or anything like that yet, because we really wanted folks to use the film to bring people together and have conversations. So if people are interested in it, we encourage them to reach out to us through our website, IYMBP.ca, the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program, and they can email us and then we can set up a screening. And that process is really simple. We don't charge fees. We'll happily accept donations, but our primary objective is to get the film in front of as many people as possible. And by screening, we don't have any requirements there either. Any size of group is fine with us. You know, we just ask that people bring their friends, their family, their community together to have a discussion around that. We're reaching out extensively to clubs all over the world. We want to see as many screenings as possible, but any group that's interested, we encourage them to reach out.
For us, it's really the discussion that comes out of the film. You know, it's funny. We had the documentary is 37 minutes long, and we've done screenings where the Q&A sessions after the film went way over an hour, in some instances up to 2 hours, because the film really, really sparks in-depth discussions. It gets even more interesting if we have Indigenous folks joining us, or if our good friend Tom Eustache is part of the screening and he's part of the Q&A session. So just like Pat said, it's not about creating income or donations for our nonprofit. It's really getting the word out and to foster discussions around reconciliation, around partnerships, about engagement with Indigenous communities.
So we're coming into winter, and so I assume that's a bit of a quieter time for the two of you. What's kind of on the horizon, and what's things looking like as we go into 2025?
We started our year very, very early with a couple of wonderful community trips. Pat and I, we went to Wakliesla Bella Bella, as it's formerly known, on BC's West Coast, very early in the year, to one pre-planning trip and then one long trip in the community where we trained local trail building crew. So we started out relatively early, and you're right, it's slowly winding down. We will be heading to, and I think I can speak for both of us, what's our favorite project, the Skawalsh Adventure Park near Hope, British Columbia. We've been working for over 8 years now with the small indigenous community there on developing this park with mountain bike trails, hiking trails, a lot of different recreational infrastructure. So Pat and I will actually meet in a week from now, and we'll spend a week on site at the adventure park. And then it's slowly winding down. The documentary viewings will continue throughout the winter time, but typically for us, now is the time to reflect on our year, pre-plan for next year, which trips do we want to take on, which communities we want to work with. So it's a time of reflection, but also a good time to take a break, take a breather.
Well, guys, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's always, I always enjoy our conversations, whether they happen on the podcast or we get a chance to kind of hang out at an event or go for a bike ride or something like that. I always enjoy time with the two of you. So thank you so much for taking this time and chatting.
Thanks for having us, Brent. Always good to reconnect. And one of these days you're going to have to come out and do a podcast with us on site, come out, do some trail building.
I would absolutely love that. I think that would be fantastic.
Same here, Brent. Thank you so much. Good luck with your podcast. I'm so happy to see you were able to continue over so many years. It's my favorite podcast when I'm walking the dogs out in the woods around Williams Lake. So thanks for having us once again. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
I'm joined right now by Flan McKenzie. He's the creator and founder of Hive Pass. Hi, Flan. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Brent. How's it going?
So maybe just to start us off, I think listeners have been familiar a little bit with Hive Pass in the sense that they've been kind of hearing about it at the start of the last few episodes. And last episode, we spoke with our guest a little bit about how their organization uses Hive Pass, but give us a good breakdown about what it is and what Hive Pass can do for trail associations.
Yeah, so primarily Hive Pass is a membership management platform, but it is designed specifically for trail organizations. There are a lot of membership platforms out there, and they are more kind of generic in the sense that they cater for a larger audience. So quite often they don't have the specific features that trail organizations need, and you also a lot of other features that you won't use. So the aim behind Hive Pass is just to make it simple and user-friendly as possible for the administrators, and also provide and engage members by offering them added benefits through the Hive Pass app. And they get they'll get the digital membership card. They can enjoy some discounts for the local businesses and receive push notifications to the device with updates on important information, weather events, trail updates, that type of thing.
There's a lot of things that are out there that come close, but it's not quite there. So it's great. I know I've definitely in the past have looked at numerous different membership software applications, and you know, you can certainly get them to kind of work for you, but there is so much that either you're not using or it just doesn't quite match what it is that you have. So it's great to kind of have something that's really tailor-made for trail organizations. How did you kind of come up with the idea? And I would assume there had to be some sort of a background in advocacy for yourself. Like, did you have a local trail association that you volunteered for? How did this all kind of start?
Oh, well, it was actually through my brother. So him and his partner were working with the Queenstown Mountain Bike Club. And back in 2019, they were interested in developing their own app for members. So I ended up getting involved in that, developed them a mobile app and kind of an administration platform to manage their members. That proved to be pretty successful. And they increased over 91% in the first year of using the app and the number of members, which was pretty dramatic. I mean, there was other factors in there too, but I like to think the app was part of that. And kind of following that success, several other larger mountain bike clubs in New Zealand approached me for similar apps, and they all wanted their own kind of individual apps branded. So I did do one of those. And then after being approached some more, I recognized the demand kind of for this niche membership solution. So I decided to create HivePass, and the initial uptake was pretty good. And then that was 2021. That happened. So it's now been three years, and we have 70 trail organizations across New Zealand, Australia, and Canada on HivePass. And looking ahead to next year, there's several organizations already kind of queued up to come on board, including some in the US. So I'm expecting to double that to 140 trail organizations next year, hopefully.
That's awesome. And I think there's going to be a lot of power with you know, more trail organizations on there. Just kind of creates a little bit more outreach, especially with what I was talking last episode about with kind of the ability to add on kind of a trail pass for people that might not live in a community, but they want to kind of tag on like a $20 kind of weekly pass or membership, that kind of thing. And I know a lot of different organizations have kind of different terminology that they use for something like that. But, you know, I can see the benefits of where if I'm buying my local trail association membership pass through HivePass, you know, to very simply be able to tag on, you know, for example, a Squamish trail pass and a Whistler trail pass, which is local to where I am. Or maybe I you know, do a trip out to New Zealand. I can tag on a pass when I'm out there as well, which is great.
Yeah, it's a challenging problem to get those visiting riders to contribute to the trails. And, you know, most riders will want to do that. It's just making it as simple and easy as possible, because any kind of friction, just the numbers just drop off dramatically.
Yeah.
In contributions. So there has been a few organizations that have used that successfully for those kind of short-term memberships, but there's definitely work to be done there to improve that. I mean, it does work really well for specific regions as well. So there's kind of a network effect. So in the Nelson region here, there's six organizations on HivePass. And because of that, they kind of have this network effect where they boost each other's numbers up. And that's specifically for the small clubs is really noticeable. And their member numbers have sometimes more than doubled. So members can sign up for one club and then they can join another club. They'll have multiple digital cards for these trail organizations that they can just swipe through. So obviously in a region, you'll go and have your local area, but then you'll also have areas within 1 or 2 hours that you go to regularly. And quite often people will belong to 3 or 4 organizations. There's actually one person on there belongs to 10 organizations. I do check it occasionally, and there's a small group of very keen people that try and sign up to pretty much every organization that they ride at.
That's awesome. Those are that's the rider we all want, I think. So that's wonderful. How does the pricing structure work for this? So if a trail organization wants to get involved, what's the fee? Is it per membership? Is it a flat rate? How does that work?
So the fee's taken at the time of the payment of the membership. And at the moment it's kind of three tiers. So it's $2.50. This is US dollars, $2.50 for the first 100 members. After that, it's $1 per member, per membership. And then over 1,000, it is 50 cents. So I am looking to kind of simplify that a little bit. in the future. But it's hard to get perfect pricing because of the number of members of these organizations. We have some with 20 members and we have some with 10,000 members. So pricing has to work across that wide range, size of those clubs. And the smaller clubs typically need more support actually than the larger clubs, because the larger clubs will have potentially paid staff that are very familiar with what they're doing.
And do you see a range for the cost of membership from these? Like you're kind of seeing a number of organizations, you know, what's the range that each of them choose to kind of charge for their membership?
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting, actually. There's some really good data that's building up there. So I think it'll be quite useful in the future to be able to say, you know, kind of give hints to these organizations when they're looking at pricing the memberships and saying, well, an organization your size in this country, in this area, typically charges, you know, between this range of prices for membership. So it'll be smaller organizations will typically charge a lower amount, larger organizations a little higher. Some organizations are primarily wanting higher member numbers, so they might only charge $5 or something for membership. There's a couple that do that, and they typically take a larger amount of donations because the membership is so low, and an increased number of members. So it kind of depends.
If a trail organization is kind of curious about Hive Pass, what's the best way for them to kind of get more information and see if it's the right thing for them?
Take a look at the Hive Pass website, which is hivepass.app. It's hivepass.app. Or you can email me, and I think Brent will probably put my details in the
absolutely show notes. Yeah, in the show notes for sure. That's great. Well, thanks, Fuan, for jumping on here and just kind of explaining a little bit more about what Hive Pass is, and I'm excited to kind of hear from some of the listeners. I've gotten some emails from folks who use it currently or have kind of reached out and started looking at it as an option, and so it's exciting to kind of hear that there's some uptake with it.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
This episode of the podcast was recorded on the traditional territory of the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Musqueam, and Stolo Nations. If you're curious to learn more about the traditional territory that you occupy and recreate on, then visit native-lands.ca. Want to host a screening of Dirt Relations, the story of the Indigenous Youth Mountain Bike Program? Email Patrick. You can find his email in the show notes, as well as a link to the trailer on YouTube. Like always, you can find the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Frontlines MTB. You can also join the Facebook group at Advocates on the Frontlines of MTB. And you can send me an email or audio file to info@frontlinesmtb.com. Thank you to everyone for contributing to the conversation as Frontlines VI peers. Thank you to Alexa, Jacob, Drew, and Jeff for your continued support via PayPal. To become a Frontlines VIP member, to receive early info about upcoming shows, you just need to support the show via PayPal. You can find the link in the show notes. Music, as always, is by Lee Rosevear. Production notes by Jennifer Pride. Artwork is created by Brandon Gallagher Watson and BGW Creative. And finally, I'm Brent Hillier. This is Frontlines. Thanks for listening, and happy trails.